Iran's foreign minister reiterates the need for a peaceful solution to the Yemen crisis, saying the blockade of the country must be lifted. The Russian foreign minister has accused the West of unleashing the war against his country, saying Moscow would like to end the war as soon as possible. And Peru's ousted president denies having committed any crime, saying he is a victim of political revenge by his adversaries. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister has reiterated the need to find a peaceful solution to the Yemen crisis through promoting inter-Yemeni talks. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a meeting with Mohammed Abdul Salam, the chief negotiator of Yemen's National Salvation Government in the Omani capital of Muscat. He criticized total air and sea blockade imposed on Yemen by the Saudi-led military coalition. Amir Abdullahian said that the blockade must be lifted in a humanitarian move so that Yemeni people can live under normal conditions. Now, lauding their steadfastness in realizing their rights, Iran's top diplomat said that the Islamic Republic will continue to support Yemenis. The Saudi-led war in the country has so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemeni people. The UN says more than 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid. The world body has also described the situation in the country as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Israel's prime minister-designate has vowed to continue expanding Jewish settlements on Palestinian land in defiance of international outcry against the move. The announcement was made in a statement by Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. The statement alleged that Israeli settlers have an exclusive right to all parts of occupied territories. It added the Tel Aviv regime will encourage and develop settlements in all parts of Palestinian land. Now all Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. The UN Security Council has time and again condemned Israel's settlement activities in occupied territories in several resolutions. Netanyahu was given a mandate to form the regime's new cabinet following his November 1st election win. His proposed cabinet has been described as the most extremist cabinet in the regime's history and enjoys the backing of ultra-Orthodox and extreme right-wing parties. The Syrian defense minister and intelligence chief have met with their Turkish counterparts in Moscow in the presence of Russian officials. This is according to Syria's official media. The Syrian media also reported that the two sides discussed several issues of bilateral interest to both countries. The Turkish defense ministry also confirmed the report, describing it as a clear sign of normalization between Ankara and Damascus. The Turkish ministry added that Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, was also present at the meeting. Crisis in Syria, the Syrian refugees, and the fight against terrorism were the major topics of discussion. The participants agreed to continue the trilateral meetings. Earlier this month, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, said he had proposed to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to work out a trilateral mechanism to accelerate diplomacy between Ankara and Damascus. The Italian government is framing a clampdown on NGO asylum seeker rescue ships, as humanitarian groups have warned the move will stop them from saving lives at sea. Italian Interior Ministry said that the measure will halt organized campaigns to bring asylum seekers departing from Libya and other countries to Italy.
Italy's far-right government is about to adopt a security decree that will introduce a compulsory code of conduct for NGO-run ships rescuing asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea. Since day one of its mandate, the Giorgia Meloni government has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what it calls irregular migration. The new measures will force NGO-run ships to deliver rescued asylum seekers to port immediately without waiting to pick up more people at sea or transferring asylum seekers to larger vessels. Under the new rules, rescued people will also have to apply for asylum in the country where the NGO-run ship is flagged in. Italy's Interior Minister Teo Piantedosi has said the new provisions aim to prevent organized campaigns to transport asylum seekers departing from Libya and other countries to Italy.
We asked if the migrant issue would be the main focus of the next year's opening council of the EU ministers' meeting. The EU needs a serious and constructive approach on the matter in order to draw a clear distinction between asylum seekers and irregular migrants.
According to the Italian government, saving lives at sea has contributed to increasing migration, and while some NGO ships genuinely carry out rescues, others engage, quote, in systematic searches for people in cahoots with migrant traffickers. Humanitarian groups have warned that the government's measures will stop them from saving lives.
Bisogna informare.
People departing from Libya and other countries for Italy must be immediately informed by the media about the risks they would face by crossing the Mediterranean Sea, so that they can reconsider their decision. The best case scenario for them is to end up in a detention center in Libya. It's hell for people in there.
Over 90,000 people have arrived at Italy's ports this year. Rome has been stopping many NGO-run ships from docking in the country, on one occasion sparking a diplomatic rift with France after an NGO-run vessel flying the French flag was denied entry. Italy's policies on the migrant issue have been strongly condemned over the years. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal authorizes Italy and the EU to help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence, and abuse are practiced. That deal today is still in place. Max Civili, Rome.
Russia's foreign minister says that he is convinced that Moscow will achieve its goals in Ukraine thanks to its patience and perseverance. Sergei Lavrov reiterated his country's position that before any talks with Ukraine, Kiev must recognize the annexation of four Ukrainian regions by Russia. He emphasized that denazification of all those regions is an absolute priority for Moscow. Lavrov also confirmed that gaining total control of Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions in the east and south of Ukraine is an essential goal for Russia. He accused the West of preparing and unleashing the war against his country, saying that Moscow would like to end this war as soon as possible. Peru's former president Pedro Castillo, who is now in jail over attempting to dissolve Congress, says he's a victim of political revenge by his adversaries. He made the remark while speaking at a hearing to appeal his 18 months of pretrial detention. Castillo said that he had not committed the crimes of rebellion and conspiracy for which he is under investigation. He described his pretrial detention as an unjust move that has only served to polarize the country. Castillo was detained on December 7th after attempting to close down parliament and rule by decree to avoid an impeachment trial. The vote, however, went ahead as scheduled and Castillo was ousted and promptly arrested. Dina Boluarte, his vice president, was then sworn in as new president the same day. Castillo's ouster sparked protests throughout Peru, which have left at least 22 people dead so far. It's the final week in office for Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro. The winner of the October 30th presidential race, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, will be sworn in for his third term this Sunday. From Sao Paulo, Camila Escalante reports.
Brazil is less than a week away from Lula da Silva's return to the presidency, and preparations are underway for a massive festival in Brasilia, which will be held alongside the official events. Tens of thousands of members of social movements and Lula supporters from around the country are preparing to travel to the capital, many of whom will be camping out to celebrate the new government at the Festival of the Future, for which dozens of Brazilian artists have confirmed their performances. There is both a sense of excitement and tension as protests against the incoming government by supporters of outgoing Jair Bolsonaro are expected. Despite multiple thwarted plots, called terror plots by the incoming government, people are determined to make their way to Brasilia.
I'm going to Brasilia from Sao Paulo to be there for the inauguration of our president Lula, who will be there, which is very satisfying and makes me proud. And I'm also looking forward to participating in the celebrations and festivities of the social movement.
I'm heading to the inauguration of our president, Lula. I want to be with him at the festivities, singing and supporting him because there are so many good things to happen in our country.
The presidential transition is advancing, and President-elect Lula has been making known some of his ministerial appointments. Among the most notable are singer, songwriter, and actress Margarita Menezes, who'll take on the role of Minister of Culture, and lawyer and writer Silvio Almeida, who serve as Minister of Human Rights. Lula's former environmental minister, Marina Silva, will take another turn heading the ministry. Sources close to Jair Bolsonaro say that he will not be handing off the presidential sash to Lula da Silva and will be taking an extended holiday at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in the United States. Camila Escalante, Sao Paulo.
Gun violence is a leading cause of premature deaths in the U.S. Gun death rates have been the highest in decades, and this year in particular has been one of the worst years. An American nonprofit group says over 6,000 children have been killed or injured so far this year across the country as a result of gun violence.
The number of children shot and killed in the United States in 2022 exceeded 6,000. The Gun Violence Archive found that at least 6,032 children, 17 years of age and younger, had been the victims of America's deadly gun epidemic. The number was the highest since GVA started keeping a record of gun violence casualties in 2014. The figure reflected a notable increase since last year, when arbitrary deployment of firearms by civilians was found to be responsible for around 5,700 casualties across the country. At least 306 children, 11 years old or younger, have been killed by gunfire, with 668 being injured. Additionally, 1,325 teenagers, aged 12 to 17, died by gunfire, with 3,732 being injured. Last month, the GVA said there had been a total of 609 mass shootings in 2022 in the United States so far, putting the country on pace to reach around 675 by the end of the year. The grim statistics come after a three-year-old girl in Kansas City, Missouri, was killed on Christmas Eve in what police suspect was an accidental shooting. The child shooting deaths in 2022 also include 19 students, all 11 years old or younger, killed in a mass shooting on May 24th at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. One of the youngest victims killed by gunfire this year was a five-month-old who was shot in the head while sitting in a car in Chicago during a June 24th drive-by shooting. The United States has been suffering from an expanding trend of gun violence and episodes of mass shootings. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden said that a flood of guns was turning American communities into killing fields.
According to new data just released by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, guns are the number one killer of children in the United States of America. The number one killer, more than car accidents, more than cancer. Over the last two decades, more school-age children have died from guns than on-duty police officers and active-duty military combined. Think about that. More kids than on-duty cops killed by guns. More kids than soldiers killed by guns. For God's sake, how much more carnage are we willing to accept?
In October, the CDC released data on U.S. firearm deaths last year, counting over 47,000, the most in at least 40 years.
Tragically, mass shootings are occurring with increasing frequency in schools, offices, and malls across America. Americans have been blaming a range of issues, from mental illness to inadequate security, for the crisis. Yet, in the ongoing conversation of the root causes of gun violence, the manufacturers and vendors are hardly ever mentioned.
The U.S. population is growing, but researchers say the rate of gun deaths has been getting worse, too. America's gun-related homicide and suicide rates both rose 8% last year, each hitting unprecedented levels since the early 1990s. In a new study, the researchers examined trends in firearm deaths since 1990. They found gun deaths began to steadily increase in 2005, but the rise accelerated recently with a 20% jump from 2019 to 2021. The researchers counted more than 1.1 million gun deaths over those 32 years. The U.S. is saturated with guns and has become a lot more so over the past decades. As deaths mount from gun-related violence in the U.S., so do the sales of firearms. Data from 2020 shows how gun production has increased nearly threefold over the past 20 years, rising from the manufacture of 3.9 million guns in 2000 to more than 11.3 million in 2020. In addition, powerful lobbying groups, including the National Rifle Association, spent nearly $5 million last year to expand gun rights while limiting curbs on who can have firearms and how they can carry it. Also, gun owners have become less likely to cite hunting or sport as a reason for their ownership, instead pointing to personal security. And despite widespread and vocal public outrage, American support for stricter gun laws in 2020 fell to the lowest level since 2014. According to polling by Gallup, only 52% of Americans surveyed said they wanted stricter gun laws, while 35% said they should remain the same. Over the last two decades, there has been a jump in the sale of high-caliber handguns and semi-automatic rifles. Figures from a Swiss-based research project named Small Arms Survey estimate that there were 390 million guns in circulation in 2018 in the U.S. Plus, the U.S. ratio of 120.5 firearms per 100 residents far surpasses that of other countries around the world.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
The limelight.
Despite economic woes in the UK, this country has decided to increase its military budget in 2024. And this decision was announced in the British publication The Telegraph. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, £1.5 billion or $1.8 billion budget increase is expected for Britain's military in 2024 to 2025, The Telegraph claims. Amid soaring inflation, The UK is set to boost defence spending in 2024 to 2025, The Telegraph has reported, citing sources familiar with the matter. The Ukraine conflict was among the reasons cited by Britain's Ministry of Defence when justifying the spending increase to the Treasury, the paper reported. The decision had already been made in principle, though final figures are expected by spring 2023 when Chancellor Jeremy Hunt may officially announce the increase, the paper adds. The British government is seeking to ensure that the defence budget does not fall relative to inflation, according to The Telegraph. We will avoid a real-term cut in defence budget, an anonymous senior government source confirmed to the paper. While former Prime Minister Boris Johnson did launch a major military investment program back in 2020, the biggest since the end of the Cold War, Britain's defence budget is still projected to fall in real terms between 2022 and 2024 due to soaring inflation, the article noted. Professor Malcolm Chalmers, Deputy Director General of the Royal United Services Institute military think tank, told the outlet that the defence budget would have to rise from £48.6 billion to £50.1 billion, that is $60 billion in 2024, to reach the government's goal. That would translate to at least £1.5 billion, that is $1.8 billion, in expected additional investment. The Treasury's reported acquiescence may be down to geopolitical concerns raised by the British government, particularly in light of Russia's military campaign in Ukraine, the article noted. Since late February, when the conflict broke out, London has been one of Kiev's staunchest backers, providing it with weapons and military training. In September, the UK government pledged to spend as much or even more than it did in 2022 on military aid to Ukraine next year. According to the press release, Britain was the second largest military donor to Kyiv, having committed some £2.3 billion, that is $2.8 billion, by that time. Russia has in turn consistently condemned Western weapons deliveries to Ukraine, claiming these only serve to prolong the conflict. Moscow has also repeatedly warned that NATO member states are getting increasingly involved in the conflict, which could potentially lead to a direct military confrontation with Moscow. Meanwhile, the Daily Star wrote, 2 years after Britain's departure from the European Union, bosses of UK businesses are reeling from cost of Brexit, including some who voted to cut ties with Brussels. It's cost with no benefit, noted Adrian Hanrahan, chief executive of a small chemicals company, Robinson Brothers, based in central England and for which the EU remains a key market. The problem is not the customs duties, largely eliminated by the post-Brexit free trade agreement between London and Brussels, but rather a mountain of new regulatory paperwork. We've added probably 25% extra now on our administration cost just to cope with the changing paperwork of getting stuff in the form and in from the EU and out of the EU, Hanrahan told AFP. The company employs 265 people, producing chemicals used by various sectors featuring food, electronics, pharmaceutical and other firms. Robinson Brothers exports around 70% of its products, of which more than half go to EU. The company is far from alone in struggling with the consequences of Brexit, with 56% of UK businesses facing difficulties adapting to new trading rules, the British Chambers of Commerce said recently. We'll be right back. Meanwhile, Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee member Swati Dhingra told MPs last month that Brexit was to blame for a much bigger slowdown in trade in the UK compared to the rest of the world. According to King College London economist Jonathan Ports, there is a reasonable degree of consensus that Brexit has reduced UK trade by perhaps 10 to 15% compared to a no-Brexit scenario. The government's own economic forecasting body, the OBR, estimates that Brexit will reduce the country's long-term output by around 4%. Complicating matters has been the loss of EU workers in sectors such as health, hospitality, and agriculture, even if some of those returning home have been replaced by staff from non-EU countries. Witnessing the fallout, some high-profile bosses who voted for Brexit are calling on the government to relax the new and tighter immigration rules. In respect to immigration, it's definitely not the Brexit I wanted, Simon Wolfson, head of clothing giant Next, told the BBC last month. Tim Martin, boss of Group JD, is of a similar opinion, saying if this continues, then we have no other option but to shrink our offering to remain in business. We have had two or three very large German customers tell us that they are no longer going to come to us because it's too complex for them to work with anybody in the UK.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners, and here is food for thought for you regarding the Noble Quran, as expounded by Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The Quran leads its adherents to goodwill, and hearing it leads to salvation. With it are the bright divine authorities achieved, his manifest determination acquired, his prohibited decrees avoided, his manifest evidence recognized, his satisfying proofs made apparent, his permissions granted, and his laws written.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, consequences of cutting from family. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the consequences of cutting from the family in the Islamic lifestyle. When we see the Islamic teachings, Islam gives importance to the family members. It gives importance to the relationship between the brothers and sisters, the father and the children, or mother of the children, and the husband and wife. So it is necessary to pay respect to these relations that we have. And those who cut from these relations or these relatives, they face consequences. The very first and least consequence which they will face is that their life becomes shorter. And this shortening of life is because we are not meeting our family members. You know, in the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, there was an idea which came up that those people, it was a scientific or the research which came up, which said that those who have relation with their family members, like brothers and sisters, who meet each other on a regular basis, even at the time of pandemic, they have more resistance against the COVID. And those who are away from their family members, who do not have their brothers and sisters next to them, who do not have their parents next to them, they are the ones who are affecting more from this pandemic. Therefore, obviously, Islam says that if you have a good relation with your family, Allah will lengthen your life. He will give you a long life. But if you cut from your family, the life becomes shortened. Why? Because sometimes Allah gives us more time to live because He does not want our family members to become angry or to have a grief or to cry for us. Therefore, when we are meeting each other, Allah likes this, Allah loves this, and He gives us more life so that we socialize with each other more than what we used to do, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the consequences of cutting the family. When we cut off from the family, there are different consequences that we need to face. And the first consequences was that the life becomes shorter. The second consequences, according to the Islamic teachings, is when a person cuts from the family, he will not have the enough sustenance, he will lack in sustenance. Therefore, the lack of sustenance, or, you know, he's earning a lot, maybe he's working, he has a good salary, but on the other hand, the money also flew away. He never knows where does this money gone. You know, his children, his kids, they're becoming sick very frequently. Maybe he has an accident. Maybe he had some kind of tax or any payment has come on him where he saw the damage or the loss, he had a loss. So somehow the money which he is earning, it goes quickly away from his hands and he cannot have the savings. Therefore, this is the other consequences when someone is cutting from the family. The third consequences is that he will not have a peace in his life. He will not, you know, some people who do not earn a lot, but whenever they have money or the salary or anything, the income that they have, when they share that with their family members, although they don't have things to eat, maybe they have one-time food to eat, but they have a peace in their life. They have an inner peace, a spiritual peace, which is letting them to spend more on their family, on their brothers and sisters, on their father, on their parents, on the mother and the father. So when they make their family members happy, they are happy too. And the other consequences is that our deeds, if we cut from the family, the deeds are becoming impure. If we want to have the pure deeds which can take us towards the perfection, we need to establish the relation between the family members, with our siblings, with our cousins, uncles, parents, brothers and sisters, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
soon.
Part 1.
He was born in a village in the heart of the desert. At the age of 5, he became a shepherd in the village, a young shepherd who grazed sheep with his bare feet, and at night his mother would remove the thorns off his hands and feet with a needle. During the entire fall and winter, he worked hard and his hands were frostbitten due to severe cold. Every time the teacher hit him on the back of his hands with a piece of wet branch from pomegranate tree, and he would start crying out loud, his father would shout from the yard in his house, "Don't hit him. Have a little fairness. Qasem's hands are not dirty. His skin has become black." And as far as he could remember, he was always waiting for the spring to come to bring warmth with it. Even though his hands never fired a bullet, they prevented many hands from shedding the blood of innocent people. And after he fell, people in the world didn't shake hands warmly for a long time. A man with a bright future, with a stature to stand tall. When he was 13, he learned about the secret of his parents' whispers at night. He found out that his dad owed 900 tomans to the agricultural bank and could not repay it. He decided to drop out of school and go to the city to find a job and lend it to his father. It was the first time he was shouldering a big responsibility, and he succeeded. At the age of 15, he enrolled in the Kerman Workers Club in the field of karate. On his card, it was written, "Become strong if you want comfort in this world, because in the system of nature, those who are weak will be trampled upon." This became the motto in his life. He had to make his shoulders stronger for bigger responsibilities. When the revolution happened, he wanted to be an IRGC soldier, but with his wavy hair and his short-sleeved shirt, and with his chest and arms revealing, his appearance didn't fit in with the people in the IRGC. That's why he was rejected by the selection committee of the IRGC. But he insisted, and it worked. Qasem became an IRGC guard. It was in his fate that his right hand was injured. It happened on the first day of the first operation he participated in. So he could no longer fire a bullet with that hand. But because of his experience in military affairs and his ability to lead forces, he remained on the front lines. Although he was a military commander, he made friends with each and every one of his forces and established personal and emotional relationships with them. In the first opportunity, he went to Mecca. After that, everyone knew him by the title Haj Qasem. G. During the 8 years of the Iraqi-imposed war, he fought in different places. Rivers, deserts, wetlands, and mountains. In his conversation on the radio, he would never say go. He would say, come here. Whenever the situation would become hard, he showed his grandeur, and no one would dare oppose him. Everyone knew that if Qasim raised his right eyebrow, there would be no room for ifs or buts, and no one could say no. He was always behind the first embankment during the operations. During the 8 years that Qasim and Iranian forces were fighting with Saddam's army on the country's western borders, the drug mafia had invaded Iran's eastern and southeastern provinces bordering Afghanistan and Pakistan. So the IRGC commissioned a base to fight the mafia, the Quds base. And Qasim became the commander of the base, where the forces of his division were all from those provinces. Qasim's new mission was harder than the war. The drug mafia had hired mainly the oppressed and indigenous people of different villages of the provinces, and the difficulty of Qasim's mission was that he had to clear these provinces with maximum peace and minimum human casualties. Although the heads of the mafia groups tried to put Qasim in a tight spot by threatening him, he did his job fearlessly. He was close to death many times, and once his children were almost taken hostage. Once armed thugs took 90 police forces hostage and took him deep into Pakistani territory, Qasim followed them on a helicopter, and after finding their hideout, he got them released. Now the mafia heads knew that they were not safe from Qasim even across the border. He warned the rest of the miscreant gangs to either lay down their arms or wait for the consequences of their evil acts. Now once again, it was time for forgiveness and kindness. Qasim tried to build an honorable life for the tribes through agriculture by building hundreds of water wells. He did not even neglect to take care of the family of the head of one of the most notorious armed gangs who was killed by his forces. So Qasim succeeded in restoring security to the southern and eastern provinces of Iran after 7 years, with the least casualties. But this was not the end of his mission. February 1998, Qasim was appointed as commander of the Quds force. The unit was responsible for the IRGC's foreign operations from Afghanistan to Lebanon. What was the mystery in the name that was tied to Qasim's life? Starting military training from the Quds garrison in Kerman, commanding the battle in Operation Tariq al-Quds, fighting the drug mafia in the Quds base, and now commanding the Quds force. There were many such codes in Qasem's life, most importantly, his right hand he could not shoot with. The beginning of Qasem's new mission coincided with the beginning of the construction of U.S. bases in Iran's neighboring countries. Al-Qaeda also infiltrated the region and sowed the seeds of religious discord. Qasem had to do something. He first flew on a helicopter through the mountains of Tajikistan to go visit Ahmad Shah Massoud. The Sunni lion of the Panjshir Valley, who had been in isolation for some time. Qasem saved Massoud from isolation by strengthening his fighting power and supporting his forces. We do not even want to discuss what it means to transfer heavy military equipment to Afghanistan in just 48 hours. Qasem's next step was to connect the nucleus of resistance to other parts of his mission. Next destination was the Iraqi Kurdistan, Iran's traditional ally. There, he strengthened his ties with the leaders of the region, as he did in Afghanistan. Training and sending military equipment and tools deepened Qasem's relationship with the Kurds. Qasem's next step was to go to Lebanon. And it was there that he found what he was looking for. Imad Mughniyeh, an omnipotent commander like himself. And Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who was a strategist, a political theorist, who was aware of the equations of the region and the world, and at the same time, a full-fledged warrior. Those two men encouraged Qasem, the companions who never separated from him, and only death left a gap between them. It was not long after Haj Qasem, Imad, and Sayyid got to know each other that the Israeli army withdrew from Lebanon after 18 years of occupation without achieving anything. Six years later, the small Hezbollah became so strong that Israel decided to eradicate it with a massive offensive. Qasem wasn't someone who would sit by and just watch the battle from a distance. 2 weeks after the start of the war, Israel did everything it could by massacring the people and destroying infrastructure to force Lebanon to concede defeat. Victory celebration, only a few people knew that someone named Ahmad Mughniyeh existed. The specter of resistance had a quote-unquote strong supporter throughout the war. False and deceitful claims of societies that champion freedom of speech, but in practice resort to any trick to control public opinion. Leaders who ordered the assassination of General Soleimani also prevent the distribution of information related to martyr Soleimani. Virtual Flags is foremost a documentation of the West's cultural and media war against the positions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, rather than simply a documentation of the mourning for martyr General Soleimani.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. In the United States, Donald Trump has shied away from criticizing white supremacist Nick Fuentes, but his one-time number two, Mike Pence, called on the ex-president to apologize for the dinner. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more details. Donald Trump repeatedly refused to disavow the outspoken anti-Semite and white supremacist Nick Fuentes after they spoke over dinner at his Mar-a-Lago resort, rejecting the advice from advisers over fears he might alienate a section of his base. Two people familiar with the situation upset. The former U.S. president was urged publicly and privately to denounce Nick Fuentes in the aftermath of the dinner, which included the performer Kanye West, who has also recently been propagating anti-Semitic remarks. But Donald Trump eschewed making outright disavowals of Nick Fuentes, the people said, and none of the statements from the campaign or on his Truth Social account included criticism of Fuentes, despite efforts from advisers who reached Trump over the Thanksgiving holiday. Donald Trump ultimately made clear that he fundamentally did not want to criticize Nick Fuentes, a product of his dislike of confrontation and his anxiety that it might antagonize a devoted part of his base, and became more entrenched in his obstinance the more he was urged to do so. Across three statements on Friday, Donald Trump initially sought only to play down the dinner and made no mention of Nick Fuentes or his views, before saying angrily in a post on his Truth Social website that evening that Kanye West expressed no anti-Semitism and I didn't know Nick Fuentes. The line about not knowing Nick Fuentes was the closest that Trump came to acknowledging the offensive nature of the dinner, under pressure from advisers who warned him that being associated with a racist and a Holocaust denier could further damage his personal brand, as well as his recently launched 2024 presidential bid. But even with his ignorance of Nick Fuentes taken at face value, the statements signal Trump will give extraordinary deference to the most fringe elements of his base, even if it means potentially losing support from more moderate Republicans who have not typically cared for his indulgence of extremism. Donald Trump has had a long history of delaying or muting criticism of white supremacy, drawing moral equivalency in 2017 between neo-Nazis and counter-protesters at the deadly unrest in Charlottesville, Virginia, and refusing to denounce the far-right Proud Boys militia group at the 2020 presidential debate. The halting response to Nick Fuentes most closely mirrored his inability to condemn white supremacist groups after Charlottesville, the people said, when Trump faced intense criticism for not naming the right-wing groups in the bloodshed that ended with the death of a young woman. When reached for comment, the Trump 2024 campaign said the former president had a record of combating anti-Semitism, including the appointment of a special envoy to combat anti-Semitism and strengthening ties to Israel by recognizing Israel's annexation of Golan Heights. The circumstances of the dinner at Mar-a-Lago on Tuesday, though, have been a new source of consternation for aides, who privately concede that Kanye West should never have been allowed to meet with Donald Trump in the first place, given his own recent anti-Semitic history. Donald Trump had intended to meet with Kanye West one-on-one for some time, according to a person briefed on the matter, though it was postponed around the time that Kanye West tweeted offensive tropes against Jews, only for it to be inexplicably rescheduled for late November. The former president ended up meeting with Nick Fuentes, who was at the unrest in Charlottesville, Virginia, after he came along with Kanye West and a former Trump campaign aide, Karen Giorno. There was only a skeleton staff from Trump's 45 office at the property ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday. During the dinner, the person said Nick Fuentes told Donald Trump he was among the former president's supporters, but that he had been unimpressed with the 2024 campaign launch speech because it appeared stilted instead of appearing authentic, with his ad-libs and off-the-cuff remarks. The website politico.com has also covered the same story and gives us more details. A flurry of top Republicans on Monday, 28th of November, took a familiar approach to Donald Trump's dinner with white nationalist and anti-Semite Nick Fuentes, condemning the former president's actions, but not the man himself. Donald Trump's one-time number two, Mike Pence, was a notable exception, though. President Trump was wrong to give a white nationalist and anti-Semite a seat at the table, Mike Pence told News Nation in an interview. He added, and I think he should apologize for it. Trump's vice president joined several GOP members of Congress in blasting Trump's dinner last week with Nick Fuentes, who has often shared